today I'm going to talk about scale, cloud scale, and methods, systems, and programming models for dealing with cloud scale. I'm the director of development for the networking team in Microsoft Azure. And so I'll really be talking about work of produced by about 160 engineers over the course of the last 3-4 years. And I know this is a diverse audience and interested in cloud in general. I'm gonna focus on network. But that really the principles should be familiar to people working on compute and storage. And there, I think there's a message in there for people interested in cloud in general on how to make it highly reliable and do what you want it to do. I think if you're interested in this topic of software-defined networking, SDN, want to know what it's about, there'll be a lot in here for you too. Really what it means now is that systems are much more open than they were before. And so you can essentially go after problems using all the normal and good tools that you get from computer science and distributed systems. So I'll expose some of those core problems and some of the core systems and solutions. So for example, if you're not working in networking, you might think that networking is all about manipulating large graphs and keeping track of diverse state. And that's what it is about. Although in the past, the graphs were implicitly derived from the network by plugging things in, and then the protocols would kick into action, and the graphs would emerge. Whereas if you take an SDN approach, and you're in a cloud, it's really not about emerging graphs. It's about telling the systems what kind of graph you want, and manipulating those graphs to get your goals achieved. And I hope to show you how that works. So first, I just want to give a little bit of background on cloud scale and what's going on at Microsoft with Azure, and really want to just give some kind of notion of what is scale and what is growth. The answer is that it's the growth is amazing, and scale is large. So in terms of compute instances, we went from 100,000 to millions over these 4 years. In terms of storage, again, we went, from tens of petabytes to exabytes over these 4 years. And in terms of just raw network capacity, it's been even faster. Went from tens of terabits per second to petabits per second total capacity in the data centers. A little bit more about Microsoft Azure. It's really what's going on all those compute server instances is that people are outsourcing their business to the cloud. And so, for example, more than half of the Fortune 500 companies are now in Azure. And in terms of just the agility that you have to sustain, we get every 6 months, we get about a doubling of compute and storage. This data is about 6 months old, but we get at that time about 1,000 new customers a day, and all kinds of new applications on top of SQL databases, websites, authentication service, and so on. So that's what scale is. It's these huge numbers. You can think of tens of mega data centers all around the world and lots of satellite data centers as well. The question is, how do you program that? How do you manage it? I'm really going to talk about two aspects of that. And so one will be around graphs and infrastructure build out. And I'll talk about three components that have been built in Microsoft Azure: NetGraph, Network Graph Generator, and Network Graph Service. And then I'll get into, afterwards, the second part of the talk, which is about management applications on top. There again, getting back to what I said at the beginning, you'll see that there's more to SDN than just the flow abstraction. Flows are important in managing flows, that's important, but there's a lot more there too in SDN. And in particular, I'll talk about something we call the network state service, and talk a little bit about how that works. And I'll talk about important applications, upgrading the software, how to deal with failures, and how to do traffic engineering. So again, the focus is on physical network here. And I'll talk about the key problems we have to take care of. So let me talk first about the infrastructure build-out type problems. So what if you just tried to build a massive data center network or massive wide area network today, what would you see? Well, you have lots of different devices, lots of different vendors, lots of different technologies, and if you're coming at it from industry, you'll have lots of different teams. You know, some will have built this piece, and some will have built that piece, and things will have changed, and so you really are confronted with a mishmash of languages and data models, and without any consistent language for describing architectural intent and having that intent enforced in code. The infrastructure itself brings lots of challenges. Typically, things are only partially defined. Even though people have attempted to master all this complexity, there'll be details that are left out. Just because, again, you have this incredible rate of change. When I showed you that compute and storage were doubling every 6 months, to deal with that, you're introducing new technology every 6 months, and you're updating the software every 6 months, and actually a lot in between those 6 months. So things change, and this kind of drift between what was done 6 months ago and what's available now is not good for managing large systems. So you have to combat that drift. So you need to be able to describe everything and deal with everything in code. It's not like there's one application in SDN terms, one controller. Logically, there is one controller, but internally, there's lots of applications that need to interpret and access this data. And they need quick access both to the raw data and to the processed data. And they're running in parallel concurrently. So for those three problems, here are three techniques. So we have developed a net graph that I'll describe to you, which gives you an abstract data model for this this complex network. We have applications for generating that graph and actually making sure that the graph has adhered to the design requirements and all the constraints imposed by the designers, and you don't miss any details. And then we have a service that consumes and provides a in-memory graph database on this graph model, and applications can access this through a RESTful API. And one of the things that you get from this is the ability to constantly validate different aspects of the design. So, for example, one of the essential parts of running a network is access control. Who gets to speak to who? What clusters get to speak to what clusters? What customers get to speak to what services, and so forth? And these access control lists our world to themselves. There's been a lot of good work in the research community and in particular at Microsoft on how to validate network-wide consistent access control lists so that can run constantly. And really, lots of other tools, you know, to make sure that, for example, that when you're doing a maintenance, there's enough spare capacity to so that the maintenance doesn't impact running service. All this kind of validation can run constantly, all the time, on top of the graph. So what do I mean by graph? It's really common CS notions of nodes, links, and you know, now with flows, which typically people nowadays focus on flows and flow management, but they're just one of the elements. The typical routing problem that gets discussed in networking conferences is which flows, these little orange rectangles here are supposed to indicate flows, get mapped to which paths in the network. That's the routing problem. You have a graph, you have to put forwarding paths along the graph, and then you classify flows and put them on those paths. That's essentially the networking problem. Other flows will take other paths, and there'll be policies about what kind of paths are allowed for what kind of flows. There'll be some flows, for example, DDoS-type flows that you don't want to even allow into the network, and you'll have policies for banning those flows. So now I want to open up a little bit the hood and go into some details. I have about three or four slides on this, just to give a feeling for what it means to describe this graph in more detail. So the graph really is layered. There is a physical network component, and the physical network really is the bottom layer, the first layer. And you want to give full details device by device, link by link, every device, every link. So you need to capture the servers. So servers are also networking devices, increasingly so. All the switches, so you have tens of thousands of switches. The power distribution units, they're also networked. And out-of-band networks and terminal servers and power networks and other network-attached resources. So these things have names, they have roles, they have SKUs, which really is the set of consistent hardware choices you've made and deployed all across the network for one generation, and where these physical devices are. And similarly for the links, there's are we talking about Ethernet links, power, serial links, what's the start point and end point of the link, what's the type, what's the bandwidth. So in this little example, I have four devices, two devices that are spine devices. You can see the word spine in there at the top, and two devices that are leaf devices. Spine and leaf are just different roles that devices can play in a data center network. This is really a somewhat obscured snippet from a real network graph. And so you see that things have things are described in XML with normal XML tags. It could be JSON, something else. That's not that important. We've talked about SKU and the name of the device and the location in this case is encoded by the host name. There's a lot more to location than just the host name, but it's not in this snippet. You really need to know exactly where devices live. One thing about I could say about data center networks, about data centers in general, and how they differ from conventional, let's say the network in this hotel, is you know exactly where everything is. So nothing, it's an engineered artifact, and nothing gets just plugged in. If something were just plugged in, you would notice it and remove it from the network. It's really important that everything's plugged in into the right place, and I'll talk about that in a bit. You don't want any judgment calls or any creativity in things like where things get plugged in. On top of this, what in networking we call a layer one graph, the physical graph, there's other layers, you know, the Ethernet or layer two layer, and the IP network or layer three layer. And you can think of that as annotating some of those objects that are in the data plane. So you have IP ranges, IP prefixes, VLAN tags, lag, which is a bundle of links at layer two that act as one at layer three, access control list, tunnels that run from one switch through a number of switch to an endpoint, various kind of tunnels like label switch paths. The links give you the associations between these data elements and how they relate to the physical network. For example, we have IP running on Ethernet, IP running on VLANs on Ethernet, IP running on link aggregation groups running on Ethernet. So here's another snippet. Here I have two devices. The top one is a spine, and the bottom one is a leaf device in the data center. And I have extracted some elements of the interfaces of the links. The interfaces are the two ends of the of a link, and then the you can see there's a keyword attached to, which binds the interface to, in this case, loopbacks, which are implicitly defined names on the routers. And then I'm saying, well, hey, there's a loopback IP interface name. It's this 100.100.36.0/32. It's a fully qualified or fully extended /32 loopback address. And then I'm saying, oh, but I also want to connect to a management network, which is a big network, a /26 network, this 10.6.202.3/26. And that's also specified here in this snippet. So you can see the details getting layered onto the graph. On top of this, there'll be a control plane graph. So here, I'm one of the control plane protocols that commonly gets used in networking is the Border Gateway Protocol, BGP, and it's used for advertising what routes are available or what IP addresses are available behind which locations in the network. So you need to specify the BGP configuration on all the routers. We also have, for example, network appliances like software load balancers that'll run BGP as well. And so there's BGP running not just on the tens of thousands of routers, but BGP running on the millions, not every server necessarily, but on quite a few of the servers. Then you'll also have SWAN is the name of our wide area software-defined networking project, and we'll have to specify the control elements of the SWAN controller as well. And then BGP is established on each of these control plane elements, and you'll have to set up BGP sessions on every link. So here's an example. Again, a snippet taken by obscuring slightly the real thing. You see that I've got an example of a spine router, and it's not important to know to understand the details here, but I'm specifying all the little BGP details, like this thing called the ASN, the autonomous system number, and it's spelled out here. And then below it, when I get down to the session level details, I'm talking about the specific BGP session, where it starts and where it ends. So you really have a layered graph, and you need to put it all together. There's a physical network graph, a data plane graph, a control plane graph, and they have common keys, for example, the host names. And this describes the whole data center network. And in addition, the wide area network and the edges that touch the internet. This gives you the static state, the intended state of the network. And just to give you a feeling for how much change there is, you might get, up to a few thousand changes to this graph a day. There'll be moments in time where there'll be lots of, upgrades going on where you'll be sweeping through it. There could be quite a few changes in a 5-minute interval. So even though I call it static, it's being built out and operated on. At this scale, it's not so static. But you really think about it. You have a graph, and now you need to slice it, pick up elements of it that you need for management and application virtualization. So that's the graph. Let me tell you now. Try to wake people up a little bit and tell some stories about the graph. What was it like before the graph, before we invested in this SDN journey some 4 years ago? And this is how it's like, let's say, in this hotel, or when they're trying to wire up the network, or in your university if you're working there, or in most enterprises. So on the left-hand side, you have let's say the system integrator or architect who's designing your network, and he's specifying what he wants in various forms like emails, PDFs, spreadsheets, where he's listing what devices he needs, maybe Visio, and iterating with a cloud hoster or the network administrator. At some point, he'll have the design. And he'll provide it to this guy in red, the deployment team, and the deployment team will have to obtain equipment from a fabricator, someone who will Dell or HP or whoever that provides the actual racks and gear in them, and so he will get a PDF file. And then he will generate XML and cable maps and so forth that'll describe how to wire up and validate the entire network. In a well-run system, you'll also have wire checking running. So if wires are not placed in the right ports, then the wire check service should flag that. So what do you get? Well, you get some things that are not so good. You get vendor-specific formats. Let's say this switch vendor, this server vendor has a different way of talking about their devices. And the files will be in formats that change in time depending on the integrator. The formats will be Excel, PDFs, emails. Typically, there'll be interchange of it. What does this field mean, really? It's hard to interpret. Something like code review is not normal in this world. It's hard to get peer review. There'll be information that's missing, and it's really hard to integrate and sorry, to automate. So this is a little picture of a real build, there's a rack that's labeled B here. So the question that's asked or challenge for you is, do you see any differences between, of course you can hardly see the slide, but the version on this version and the version on the previous slide. And this is the, again, you're building at massive scale. You're adding thousands of servers every day or so, and how are you going to check to see if the what gets built out is actually what was intended? And by the way, if it doesn't get built out on time, then you'll start to queue up more work for the data center build out team. And they'll start to fall behind, and you'll start turning away customers, and it's not a pretty story. Incremental build out is just part of life in the cloud. So you're constantly decomming, constantly building. In essence, you'll have to debug this. And what the difference is that a port number was changed from 43 to 47. Now there's automated applications in the cloud for powering off things that are faulty. So for example, if these automated applications have their own redundancy. So for example, if you want to power off a server, you try to use the PDU to power it off. Sometimes the PDU will fail. if that PDU fails, you'll have to go to the top of rack switch and shut down the port, which will isolate that server, and then you'll send somebody to take care of the failed PDU at some other time scale. So if you get any of this wrong, you'll shut down the wrong server. Which means you've just not only you've not solved the problem, but you've caused another problem. And if you do this more, it'll cascade. So getting these details right is really just the life of running a cloud. So with the graph model, these bad things went away, and the build-out became much more predictable and correct and fast. So days and days of time debugging were just removed by introducing the graph service. So you still need to, humans still have to get into the act on the left to figure out what is the right design. And even if you have some general notion of the right design, there can be really important variations in depending on how technology has moved in 6 months or so when you go to build it out, and there can be important physical constraints you need to take care of in terms of how high the racks can go and things like this. But you don't want many people working on that piece. So these guys on the left are designing it, getting it right, at which point they turn over really the job. There's a graph generator that I'll talk about in a minute, and it feeds the graph service, and then you have the authoritative topology in there. At that point, now you have a wire checker that can run off the intended data, not the partially described intended data, but the fully described intended data, and produce the cable maps and the checks. So it vastly simplifies the work. There's no back and forth. Things are deterministic and get wired up and checked with confidence. So what are these tools looks like? Well, again, there's the you need to empower the designers, the guys on the left in my picture, to prescribe a network design. What does it mean? You want to be able to, the job of the graph generator is to encode the network topology. I mentioned spine and leaf. If you're a network person, you might know that the leafs are at the edges and the spines are in the middle, and you have to wire them up precisely. There's an incredible number of links in these networks because you can't load more speed necessarily on the same link. Instead, you have more links to get more speed. You have to check the assignment of IP addresses. For the BGP part, you have to check the autonomous system numbers and make sure the things are named correctly. This is super important. If it's wrong, you could wind up losing traffic, misrouting traffic, or delaying a build out, as I said. In terms of how you go about describing this, it's a talk in itself, but one thing that we've learned, and I've learned in my career, is to provide limited parameterization. I think I've written 10 different template-based graph generator tools in my career that provided way too much flexibility. You want, in some ways, to limit the flexibility. So you want the same SKU to be used everywhere. You want a consistent pattern for using IP blocks, and then in terms of how many servers, how many spine devices, how many leaf devices, you want something like small, medium, large. You don't want the world of you want two smalls to make a medium. You want simple things that that can be composed instead of every possible outcome. And when it gets to generating the design, it means that don't go with scripting, and don't go with little languages that are designed just for the data center. Instead, focus on the data model, and focus on common methods for manipulating the data model, instead of designing a custom language that provides great flexibility. if you do design the scripting model or something like that, you'll find that everybody's got a script. They'll have encoded things in ways that are personal, and you really can't do that at this kind of scale. So you need the model to be the thing, and everything else consume the model and just generate in simple ways. So how do we generate the graph? I'll show some graphs in a minute. You start with a high-level design. You fill in the concrete details. And again, I'm emphasizing every little bit of those details. You go from that high-level declarative design, give me this data center in the eastern U.S. or India or wherever you want to go, at a high level, based on the objectives of that data center, and then you generate the prescriptive graph. Though I criticize a little bit the PDFs and so forth, you do need to be able to produce documents for people to look at for troubleshooting and building monitoring tools, reasoning about things. So this is the kind of graph that that gets generated for the L2, L3 network. You'll see that there's devices that there have different colors, they're in different roles, there are border routers here, there's spine switches, there's objects that are collections of servers called pods and things like that. That's all described by the model. And there are other networks too. There's a power network, there's an out-of-band network for management, there's a serial network also for management. These things are also described and built by the same tools. And really, all I'm trying to convey is that by this picture, is the topology is complex and has multiple layers. And these layers will interact. The power network will interact with the out-of-band network and the production network for carrying traffic. So in the end, what you get is a service that applications can query. we like now to use RESTful interfaces so that they can use our other tools, for example, our load balancer, so we can scale out the access to the graph service. What is this graph service? Really, it's an in-memory graph database, and everything is versioned. So what you described and built 6 months ago is still there, and all the versions and updates are there. We derive other data on top of it, which is called cooked data, and we can access and query that. We have a presentation layer, and we can, you know, collect objects. We can do graph database kind of things, like collect objects that are accessed frequently together and put them together so we can get high-speed access. And this is a fundamental building block in Microsoft for config generation and network management. So now I'm going to talk about state. So that's about graphs, and you know, massive graphs, detailed graphs. And now I'll talk about state and applications. So what are some of the problems with networking and managing state? So there's always something, there's something happening in the network, and say unexpected. We know there's going to be failures of various kinds, bugs and so forth in the switches. Even if they have one in a million chance, they're going to happen in a cloud every day. We have that many objects to deal with. So when these events that are not expected happen, then they will interfere with expected planned work, like workflows that are done to update the network. You can predict that, yeah, there's going to be 100 links that will fail today, but we don't know where, and it's sometimes hard to predict the consequences to all these applications that are running in the network. The other thing is that it's not like we can serialize work in the network or in the cloud in general. There's always activity going on. There's always new applications rolling out. Again, I mentioned DCOM and building out new services. It's all happening. And as you can imagine, really, it's what's different about networks is that these things interact in a network. I think some of the networking problems are more challenging, perhaps, than compute and storage problems. That's why you blame the network if you're a compute and storage guy, because you say, hey, everything looks good for me. It must be the network. It's because things interact across the network. And these interactions are difficult to track. And if things are misconfigured in some way, you can get major damage. If I have indifferent applications going on to update the cloud, then I potentially could be looking at it, or the network, a N-squared problem to anticipate those interactions. Really, it's hard to test for that. So we take what we call a target state-driven approach. For every operation that we want to change in the cloud, we will have an observed state. And then we'll have a target state for that, where that operation wants to take the network, and then an updated state that we'll try to drive into the network. So we're constantly trying to reconcile the observed state with the target state. And so it's not like an open loop workflow to do something. It's like we have posted a task, and we are not going to take no for an answer until that task is done. We might back off or something or react to error messages, but we're constantly checking if the system is in the target state. The way we deal with concurrency is we use a centralized state management system called the Network State Service, which I'll tell you about. So here's an example. of two different applications that could conflict. So in one application, you know, for traffic engineering, TE, we'd like to carry a certain kind of traffic from A to C through B. We have another application running called Switch Firmware Upgrade, which would be wanting to update the state of B to enable some new features or fix a bug. So it would be a bad thing to not somehow resolve the conflict between the traffic engineering and the switch firmware update, because the traffic engineering won't succeed while the firmware update is happening. So how do we deal with it? We use a entity attribute value model. I'll show you an example. The entities are taken from the net graph that I talked to you about earlier. The properties are state attributes, which I'll show you examples of, and you'll see what the values look like from the examples. They're in a finite range. And this is really talking about the absolute value of these objects. Now, they're observed, so they may have changed since the last observation, but we're not talking about the relative things we're going to do to them, like bring it up or down. We're going to say, is it up or is it down? Okay? So here's some examples. I have a device and a link. I have attributes like power state, firmware version, CPU load level, and the values that you can see here, up or down, version number, low, high, full, or medium. Similarly for links. Now, really what we see is the benefit of this state manipulation system network state service is that we have a simple, understandable way to transform state in this huge system. And we're constantly reconciling state between what we see, what's observed, and the network itself, the target. So some network management applications don't have this intermediate layer of the state service and go directly to the network. We don't. If our management applications go to the state service and observe what's in the state service, propose what they want, and then give it to a update service to make it happen. I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. Some of the things that we can deal with here is changes. We will see that a device failed or a link failed, and we want to bring it back. We'll do the appropriate escalations or repair operations to make that happen. We will be updating the software, changing the attributes, for example, the IP addressing, and we will deal with failures in this state. Here's a schematic of what it looks like. You have the network at the bottom, and you have monitoring agents, stateless monitoring agents. They're just given jobs to do, and they go do them, and they populate the observed state. This observed state will live in a globally available, a scalable cloud store. Then the management application will run on top of the observed state. You know, let's say it's firmware update. It will propose a new firmware version for a device, for example, and then give that over to a set of validation routines, which is really a luxury. You can add more and more validation as you go, and you find the need to do that for bugs and so forth. And then you can give that over to a stateless target state driver that will the target state will be persisted in the store, and then the stateless drivers will be these updaters that will then take the the target states and try to make them happen in the network. So in a little bit more detail, you have monitors. And they earn the state and write to the observed state. They write the observed state to the store. You have management applications, which will run the business logic on the network and propose the target states. You have the checkers, which will make sure that the updates are safe, and the updaters that will drive change into the network. So NSS is the network state service. One thing we like about it is everything except for the middle NSS piece is stateless. So failures in these guys that monitor and update are just fine. They can just go back to the state, the NSS, to get new state and new work to do. If the NSS itself has a partial failure, then it can be, you can relearn network state from the monitors. things might have changed, so you have to do some of that anyway. And the proposed and target states are stored persistently with very, very, very high confidence using our cloud scale persistent store. We're enabled to deal with unexpected deviations because of the devices fail. There's a bug in a maintenance process. Whatever happens in the system itself or in the network itself, we can take care of. So here's a quick sketch of the switch firmware update. You can see in the middle, I've got my observed state, my proposed state, my target state. And you can see at the bottom what I'm really trying to do. I'm trying to just update the firmware version, which is going to do a lot of stuff, by the way. I mean, in a network, the agent will have work to do. I mean, if you're going to take a device out and update its firmware, you want to make sure that you don't impact production traffic. So you have to, prepare the network for the update, make the hit on flows in the network minimal. So in essence, you scare traffic away from the object being updated. Then you go in and update it, validate it, bring it back. And all that's done using the network state service. There's a certain kind of link failure that happens when you have hundreds of thousands of links that you have to take care of automatically. You can't have people diagnose these things, where you'll start getting bit error rates or various kinds of defects on links. The way we build the network is that's okay. You can have defects on links. We have lots of links. So the only thing that's not okay is not knowing where those defects are and letting them persist. So your monitor will tell you about the defects, and then you'll do some validation to make sure that the monitor is accurate, and then you'll go disable those links. And this is all done through the network state service again. Now, they're marked out of service, will also be taking care of what's wrong with them on a more relaxed time scale. But we want them out if they have a defect quickly. This has been running for some years in Microsoft data centers, and it takes care of this vast infrastructure. I skipped one thing. I want to see if I can get to it. I have it here. I'll use a backup slide. One of the applications that I didn't show you before I wrap it up is traffic engineering. The basic elements of traffic engineering are that you have different priorities of work in your cloud, in your network, and you want to be able to mark priorities appropriately at the host. So you have workload prioritization and marking happening at every host, and then those priorities are fed into the network. and through these through the monitoring system into the network state service. If there is some kind of overload or congestion in the network, then you'll use those priorities to decide what goes and what doesn't, so that you can run the network at high utilization, although some under stress, some applications may be squeezed and have to be throttled back at the host. That's accomplished through SWAN controller, which again, you can see this gray box in the middle uses the network state service to learn the state of the network and then propose changes to it, and then use the agents on switches and protocols to make those changes happen. Okay, sorry, I missed that slide. So the what I get is a from kind of the war of all these protocols and so forth and conventional problems in networking. Instead, I get this uniform, consistent software infrastructure, which supports lifecycle management of the data centers and the wide area network. Stepping back, the goal of the team and in essence the goal of cloud service management as applied to networking is really to apply all the core concepts to the network that have been applied and continue to be applied for managing large compute and storage clusters. For example, large in-memory graph databases. The problem had been that we just don't have the abstractions and the associated graph management systems. And the nice thing about the new world of networking is, okay, we can take care of that. So we can come up with the natural abstractions and systems to deal with tremendous scale. And I gave you a few examples, the graph service and the state service. A lot of this you can find in papers. We've done a lot of joint work with Microsoft Research, there's been some conference. For example, SIGCOM is a good place to look for some of the Microsoft contributions, and there are other conferences as well that that have some of these papers, ideas described in papers. At this point, I'll wrap up and mention, of course, that we're hiring.
I think we've reached the question point. I'm David Lin. I'm from Vanderbilt University, and I'm kind of a poser at a cloud conference. I'm looking forward to cloud, but I'm not ever going to be a cloud provider unless I come to work for y'all. At what level does this sort of overhead become worthwhile? I mean,
I see.
Y'all are dealing at huge scale, and
right.
Most of us are going to be clients at best, customers.
Right. Pretty much what I found you can tell me if this is correct at your university. You have a lot of machines, they're in a room, and the room is overheated. You can't put one more light bulb in, or you'll blow some PDU or something. And you have a lot of data and a lot of compute you want to do. So I think that it makes sense to treat the even the enterprise as a carefully engineered artifact. I don't any longer think of it as overhead. I think of it as just life. I think life before that in networking, for example, if I had a new network device, I'd plug it in and somehow the network would learn about it. But I don't know if you'll get the intended result that way. So I feel like it's true that you don't have the same rate of change or the same scale, but you probably have similar needs for, you don't want to think about network problems, and so you want a tightly engineered artifact. And the other thing is, what you get from this approach is a lot of options. So, you know, in the conventional approach to networking, the network providers would give you a, they would somehow take care of this problem with a proprietary closed system, and now you have options. You can do your own, you can pick whatever device, you don't care as much, and you can also pick different control plane providers or write your own.
I have one more question. If you, you mentioned a couple of times about versioning. Could you tell us what is versioned and where it is versioned?
Sure. So the essentially all objects are versioned in the graph database. And the versioning persists. I guess it's a little bit fractal at every level. So we need to know the provenance, I guess, of all the updates ever done on a device so that we can see what's going on with it. And we also need to be able to roll back if there's an issue. So one of the things that I should have mentioned, roll back, that's important, that when you have this constant update process going on, then one way you make it safe is you have watchdogs that are watching the rollout, and if the rollout is not doing well, then it will automatically pause it, roll it back, and then the developer of the application that caused the problem, or the firmware, whatever that caused the problem, can be rethought and rolled out again next week.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jonathan Apava from Boston University. First, thanks very much for that talk, because it's really interesting, especially as an academic, to be able to get that opportunity to see this vantage point, which is just really hard to see. I mean, you postulate that these problems must exist at that scale, but it's really nice to see, okay, computer science techniques being applied in a very methodical fashion, and it does work, opposed to just saying it works.
Yes.
But that aside, so actually this last little comment was actually part of the question I had. So, in the update cycle for these kind of state changes, it seemed to me that inherently that you must end up in these situations where effectively you're trying to identify a quiescent point and then you want to apply this update, and that it must be very hard with that change rate to always necessarily ensure you're going to hit a quiescent point.
Yeah.
And so is it very much this watchdog back off alarm and then decide?
Good question. So. We can't rely on, so we would like to have a quiescent point, but it's, we have sort of relaxed into or come to the conclusion that it's we can't ensure one. We can't say that, hey, okay guys, nobody changed the network and traffic engineering while we do some firmware update. And even if we did that, Mother Nature would come in and fail some links. So we have to have enough. First of all, like you mentioned, the rollback and so forth, we have to have a change not cause itself a big problem. If we made a mistake, there's a bug, we roll it back. But even if it doesn't make a mistake, it's just an intended update, it can cause a hit on the network, for example. So if it's a planned change, we have to make sure that it's essentially hitless, that we can do things like store state, update the piece we want, restore state, so that the period of time that where you see a hit is sub-second or negligible. We essentially want to avoid anything that would, at the end of the day, disturb the customer application. And at the same time, we can't disturb developer agility. Developers need to update stuff all the time. And so the way to go is to make the updates incremental and small, and componentized and make them fast.
And is that really fundamentally a human process? Like, I mean, that there, it just becomes the experience and intuition to know how to decompose the change and do it? Or do you have best, like, do you end up having people who just get really good at understanding those best practices and rules of thumbs and sort of staging out those updates? Or do you, like, do you have any automation or formalism there?
That's good. I guess we don't have anything at a meta level like that. We have SLAs. So if you want to change if you propose a change, and we do have some automation, I take it back. If you propose a change and it's going to impact SLA, then the systems, these validators, will not let it through. And at a design point, we have SLAs for all change, so that you're not going to get through test if you violate an SLA on an update. And then look, like for example, if we are changing the access control rules in a host or a network device, then that can happen for lots of reasons, and it can happen a lot, so it has to be sub-second. So these SLAs are defined by people thinking about the continuity of service for customers and cascading impacts too. There are services which depend on services which depend on services. And so at the bottom, like networking, these SLAs have to be very tight. The componentization is not automatic, but the SLAs that come with them is part of the design, and then there's automatic systems that check SLA in runtime. Yeah.
Hi, John Türkiyeci from IBM Research. One thing I'm wondering is, you laid out this very nice automation framework for configuration, and there is the validation aspect of all this. I was wondering whether you have any gaps from what you have configured to what you can actually validate, or is everything easily queryable so you know your desired state is actually met when you reach the final state?
Okay. Yeah, let me make sure I answer the question. There's a little bit of a difference between the build-out part and the lifecycle management part. And really, it's the way you handle errors. So in build-out, we are, for example, if a link is having a problem, we will have to stop the build-out. We don't want to go live with we have to have a certain kind of working set, all operational. So the management application for build-out is less tolerant, I'd say, of working around issues that happen. But it, other than that, it's going to produce full details and then start running validation as things are getting built, provide feedback if there are people cabling to those people, and not sign off. The application won't sign off until various burn-in tests and network-wide validation acceptance tests are done. After that's done, the network is kind of in production. There's less radical changes allowed, right? Because you have production stuff going on. So that's where you have to go into the process of, if there's a link or a device or a server that you'd like to power off and it won't power off, you have to go through the automated escalation process and do things that that are more, I'd say, involved and gentle to the application than you would do during build out. Did I get the question?
Yes, pretty much, I think. So, like, PowerOff is, I think, relatively easier example. Let's say access control is probably tougher to validate. I think the best you can do is, like, query the configuration. But after that, I think you have some kind of an incident tracking to see if something is unexpected.
I see. Okay, yeah. So for access control, that's a great topic. And I should have pointed to some papers we have on access control. So for access control, really, you want to protect a perimeter for an entire application. Let's say all storage has a certain access control, or every tenant has a certain access control. and the these access control rules can conflict and overlap, and so you have to reason about them. And so it's actually formally a tough problem. On the other hand, you have to solve it. There's no way you cannot solve it at this scale. So we have automated methods that constantly check access control. They do SAT solving and things like this that cope with the tough problems. And they flag violations and the kickoff repairs.
Thank you.